40 greetings to all our Voice of America listeners. This is VOA's Sonny Young in Washington. Thanks for tuning in this evening. Welcome to the sunny side of sports.
Stand up! Stand up! Stand up! Stand up!
Friends, we can all listen to the sunny side of sports.
Yes, my friend.
The sunny side of sports.
Sunny side of sports.
The sunny side of sports show.
Great show, bro. This is Sunny Side of Sports.
Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.
Voice of America!
Stand up! Stand up! Stand up! Stand up!
Ghana is going against Cameroon this evening in the second semifinal at the Africa Cup of Nations football tournament in Gabon. Kickoff is scheduled for 1900 GMT UTC in Gabon's southeastern city of Franceville. The winner of the Franceville football fireworks will face seven-time Nations Cup champion Egypt in Sunday's final in Gabon's capital, Libreville. The Pharaohs of Egypt scored a dramatic penalty shootout win Wednesday over the Stallions of Burkina Faso in Libreville. I'll have more on that match. But first, let's take a look at Ghana-Cameroon. Both the Black Stars of Ghana and the Indomitable Lions of Cameroon have proud Nations Cup pedigrees. They've each won four Nations Cup titles, but Ghana has been frustrated in recent years in the knockout stages. This marks the sixth consecutive Nations Cup that the Black Stars have reached the semifinals, but they haven't been able to win the trophy in any of them. 2 years ago in Equatorial Guinea, Ghana lost to neighbor Ivory Coast 9-8 on penalty kicks in the Nations Cup final. In the quarterfinals in Gabon, Ghana beat the Democratic Republic of Congo 2-1, getting second-half goals from brothers Jordan Ayew and Andre Ayew. Ghana's assistant coach, Maxwell Konadu, says, and I quote, "One thing we all dream to achieve is to win the cup this time around." The last time Ghana won the cup was in 1982 in Libya. Cameroon's last Nations Cup trophy came in 2002 in Mali. The Indomitable Lions, in reaching the semifinals, have put behind them the withdrawals of some key players before the tournament kicked off. In the words of Cameroon defender Fai Collins, and I quote, "The players who didn't come have their own personal reasons why they didn't come, and we're not looking back." Well, if we look back to the quarterfinals, Cameroon edged Senegal 5-4 on penalty kicks in Franceville. As I mentioned earlier, Egypt advanced to Sunday's final by beating Burkina Faso on penalty kicks. Egypt's 44-year-old goalkeeper, Essam El Hadary, saved two spot kicks in the shootout as the Pharaohs won 4-3. El Hadary is the oldest player to compete at a Nations Cup. He saved attempts from Kwaku Kofi and then Bertrand Traoré to once again help Egypt make it to the title game. El Hadary was part of Egyptian teams that won three consecutive African titles in 2006, 2008, and 2010. The Egypt-Burkina Faso quarterfinal went to penalty kicks after a one-all draw after 120 minutes of football. Mohamed Salah scored for the Pharaohs in the 66th minute, and then Aristide Bansé got the equalizer for the Stallions 7 minutes later. Kick it, Bill!
Kick it!
Yeah.
This is the voice of America. Washington, D.C.
Friends, we can all listen to the sunny side of sports.
Yes, my friend.
Keep on the sunny side, always on the sunny side. Keep on the sunny side of life. It will help us every day. It will brighten all the way. It will keep on the sunny side of life.
Voice of America, VOA, Washington.
I'm Sonny Young in Washington, and you're listening to the sunny side of sports on the Voice of America.
Voice of America!
During Wednesday's sunny side of sports, we heard from the late Hall of Fame boxing trainer Angelo Dundee, who was in Muhammad Ali's corner throughout his legendary prize-fighting career. This evening, the focus is on Muhammad Ali, arguably the most famous sports personality to die in 2016. In this encore Sunny Side of Sports presentation, VOA's Adam Phillips tells us about Muhammad Ali's early career and its impact.
Muhammad Ali was born Cassius Marcellus Clay Jr. in Louisville, Kentucky, on January 17, 1942, to a poor family. One day, when Cassius was 12, someone stole his beloved bicycle. A white policeman named Joe Martin heard Clay crying and vowing to beat up the thief. On the spot, Martin offered to mentor the boy at his boxing gym downstairs as a way to channel his anger. In 1960, just 6 years later, Cassius Clay would win Olympic gold in Rome.
The most popular USA winner was the lighthearted Cassius Marcellus Clay V in white here, who easily defeated Poland's Zbigniew Patrykowski. Cassius Clay, the winner for the USA.
Legend has it that back in Kentucky, Cassius Clay angrily threw his gold medal into the river because of the racism he encountered in Louisville. Still, he was quickly snapped up by a small group of Louisville investors who sensed his promise, says New York University history professor Jeffrey Sammons, who doesn't really believe that Ali actually threw his medal away. But the author of Rebel with a Cause and Beyond the Ring, The Role of Boxing in American Society, says that all the hype around Cassius Clay was certainly real enough.
He becomes a Madison Avenue creation, a breath of fresh air. Boxing had grown stale. There were all kinds of issues with organized crime. They saw in this young, brash Cassius Clay someone who would make boxing marketable in a way that it once had been. He modeled himself on, in some ways, Jack Johnson, because he talked to his opponent, but on the other hand, on Gorgeous George, who was this foppish wrestler who had all this shtick, you know, with perfume and blonde hair and effeminacy, etc., that he was the beautiful one. And of course, young Clay referred to himself as beautiful, but also as the greatest.
This is the legend of Cassius Clay, the most beautiful fighter in the world today. This I predict, and I know the score. I'll be champ of the world in 64.
This patter earned Cassius Clay the nickname the Louisville Lip.
Many people didn't think that he was for real, that he was more mouth than skill or talent. And of course, many of these opponents were not very skillful boxers, or they were well past their prime.
As when, in November 1962, Clay fought Archie Moore in Los Angeles. The man fans dubbed Ageless Archie entered professional boxing 7 years before Clay was born. Clay accurately predicted before the fight, "Don't block the aisle and don't block the door. You will all go home after round four."
Ripping punches by Clay, and Moore goes down. Cassius raises his hands over his head, and it's all over. Clay wins by a fourth round knockout, as predicted.
Soon, bigger bouts were in the offing. Ali had won all 19 of his professional fights when he challenged Sonny Liston for the heavyweight championship of the world. Hulking and powerful, with a criminal record and alleged ties to the mafia, Liston accepted Clay's challenge. The fight was set for February 25, 1964, in Miami Beach, Florida. During the run-up to the bout, Clay continually taunted Liston to reporters, calling him a big, ugly bear who even smells like a bear.
"I'm handsome, I'm fast, I'm pretty, and can't possibly be beat.
If you like to lose your money, be a fool and bet on Sonny.
When Ali showed up for the weigh-in the night of the match, the betting odds were 8-1 against him. Astoundingly, Clay vanquished Liston in the seventh round in a technical knockout.
Clay has won! Clay has won!
Then, the new heavyweight champion of the world does something else, perhaps even more dramatic. Immediately after the fight, he announces that he had converted to the Nation of Islam, that he was changing his name from Cassius Clay to Muhammad Ali. Cassius Clay is a slave name, he said. I am Muhammad Ali, a free name. It means beloved of God, and I insist people use it when they speak to me. Jeffrey Salmon says this frightened and angered many people.
Many people saw the Nation of Islam, or even Islam itself, as sort of a non-Western religion. So that made Ali an outcast. Someone said that they'd rather have someone who's identified with organized crime than to have someone identified with Islam, or in this instance, the Nation of Islam, which was known at that time by many as Black Muslims.
Although Nation of Islam leader Elijah Muhammad and his follower, the Black Power activist Malcolm X, both rejected the term, the Nation of Islam did portray whites as devils and blacks as racially and spiritually superior.
One of the things about the Nation of Islam is that it rejected integration. It believed in separation of the races, which ironically made it very popular with the Ku Klux Klan. Malcolm X actually met with Klan. It also resonated with someone like Richard Russell, who was a staunch segregationist senator from Georgia. And Russell was very supportive of Ali. So it just shows you there can be strange bedfellows in politics and boxing.
In December 1965, Madison Square Garden photographer George Kolinsky was still an amateur. He was in Miami when he spotted Ali crossing the street to the storied Fifth Street Gym, where the champ was training to fight Ernie Terrell the following March. Knowing that Ali was now one of the most famous and controversial celebrities in the world, Kolinsky decided to follow Ali inside, even if it meant using a bit of bluff with Angelo Dundee, Ali's trainer, at the door.
And I said, I'm the photographer of Madison Square Garden. At that point, I was only the photographer of my family. Angelo Dundee looked at me and he said, okay, comedian, come on in. So I went into the gym and I see Muhammad Ali working out.
What was it like to see that?
Pretty excited that I would be able to take pictures of somebody famous in an area that was pretty private. We had instant chemistry. We had, at least I had, the trust almost immediately in Muhammad Ali looking into my camera, and he somehow was trying to be good to me so that I would get good pictures.
The 8 pictures Kolinsky took that day did land him a photographer's job at Madison Square Garden. More important to Kolinsky, however, was that the initial unspoken trust he shared with Ali developed into a friendship that lasted a lifetime.
And that friendship was very, very important to me because, number one, I was able to get really great shots of probably the world's most famous-looking face. And secondly, Muhammad Ali, for all the brutality that boxing represents, also represented to me a beauty where he tried to be friendly and kind.
A current exhibit of George Kolinsky's photographs of Muhammad Ali at the New York Historical Society shows many of the softer sides of Ali behind the scenes. There are pictures that show him eating, washing up, or just clowning around. One memorable shot shows Ali napping in his hotel room between workouts. The muscle tone and gleam of his torso make him look every bit the champ. Yet one can also sense the all-too-vulnerable human being within. Of course, most of the most famous Ali photographs were shot in public, either in the ring, training, sparring with the press, or showing off to the public. Muhammad Ali was a fascinating subject, says Kolinsky, because everything he did radiated charisma.
Whenever you walk down the street with Muhammad Ali, walk into a building, into a lobby, whenever you walked into an area where there were a lot of people, everybody sort of gawked at him as if, wow, that's Muhammad Ali. How many people in this world have that charisma that he had?
Ali often projected an image of barely contained masculine rage. This was publicity gold. But Kolinsky says Ali was actually the gentlest man he ever knew.
Not many people know, unless you were speaking to him in private, that he really spoke in private in a whisper.
In 1967, the United States was deeply ensnared in the Vietnam War. It was a brutal conflict which sharply divided the American public. Muhammad Ali was one of hundreds of thousands of young American men who were drafted. He refused to serve, citing the Quran's injunction not to fight in Christian wars. Further alienating himself from the white establishment, he told reporters he had no problem with the communist Viet Cong he'd be expected to kill.
My conscience won't let me go shoot my brother or some darker people or some poor hungry people in the mud for big powerful America and shoot them for what? They never called me nigger. They never lynched me. They never put no dogs on me. They never robbed me of my nationality. Raped and killed my mother and father. How can I shoot them poor people? That'll just take me to jail.
According to Jeffrey Sammons, that's just what the government set out to do.
He's convicted of draft evasion, fined $10,000, and sentenced to 5 years in prison. Of course, there are appeals, but at the same time, the boxing authorities are also acting. They're removing his boxing license, stripping him of his heavyweight title, and his passport is revoked, so he cannot box anywhere. He can't box here, and he can't leave the country to box somewhere outside of the United States.
Ali then took to the college lecture circuit, where he got a sympathetic audience among students who also opposed the war, during what would otherwise have been the heart of his stellar boxing career.
So it's from 67 to 70 that he's not able to box and earn a living. He said, I understand it. I'm standing up for principle. You know, I can't sell myself out.
It took a lot of guts to do that, right?
Oh, absolutely. On one hand, where all of this hurt his boxing career, it made him into a legendary figure. It made him into a transcendent figure. And I maintain that that's when he really becomes the people's champ.
Muhammad Ali would go on to appeal that conviction and win that fight too, and ultimately reclaim his championship title. For the Sunny Side of Sports, I'm VOA's Adam Phillips in New York.
Keep on the sunny side, always on the sunny side. Keep on the sunny side of life. It'll help us every day. It'll brighten all our ways when we keep on the sunny side of life. When we keep on the sunny side of life.
Follow the Sunny Side of Sports on Facebook and Twitter. My Facebook address is facebook.com/VOA Sunny, and my Twitter handle is @VOA Sunny Sports. Joining us once again here in Studio 22 for a look at sports social media trends is my VOA colleague, Doug Bernard. Sporty greetings, Doug.
Sporty social media greetings to you.
Doug, what's trending in the sports world?
Well, I think you had been talking a little bit earlier in the program about the Africa Cup.
The Africa Cup of Nations.
Exactly. And that stunning victory, it was by the Egyptian team. And the goaltender, Essam El Hadary, I'm looking at his page now. He's generating a tremendous amount of activity on social media. So I'm looking at his Twitter page. He describes himself simply as Egyptian goalkeeper, 44 years old, and still counting. And that he's tweeting out himself, and other people are tweeting at him. It is almost exclusively in Arabic, which I don't speak. But fortunately, also trending right now is hashtag El Hadary.
Interesting.
So okay. The @El Hadary is his own personal Twitter account, and people can, you know, contact him directly there, and he can voice his opinions. But hashtag El Hadary is a way for people from all over to talk and, you know, a little bit about who this guy is and what an amazing job he is. And fortunately, a lot of it's in English and French, a few languages that I speak. Ahmed El Sayed, I may get some of these names a little bit wrong, just going to take a look at a few of them here. Age is just a number, and a picture of a victorious El Hadary, hands in the air, number one, great shot. More people posting images of his victory. El Hadary saves the day again. Go Pharaohs, hashtag legend. Let's see, veteran keeper, shootout hero. He's the real hero of the game. Okay, a lot of people saying he kept that shootout in Egypt's column. Let's see. This is in French, but let's see. El Hadary at 44 has qualified Egypt for the final.
The final, right?
And let's see if I'm reading this right. And he can do it. In other words, he can carry the team into victory in the final. And finally, just one more. El Hadari, you are so strong. This is again in French. You are the first guardian or keeper of Egypt, and we all respect you, and thank you for everything. So lots and lots of people sharing their thoughts and appreciation of this guy, and lots also talk about, you know, the fact that, hey, he is 44 years old, and several people already saying, look, we're looking forward to seeing him at the World Cup in 2018.
Wow.
Is it just 2018? The World Cup? I guess it is.
That would be, he would be 45, 46?
He'd be 46. So, you know, you never know. I haven't seen a lot of discussion about whether the African Cup of Nations happens too often. I think people are just kind of thrilled with that victory.
Well, let me read a couple of quick comments, Doug,
sure,
from my Facebook friends.
Yes.
This is actually a couple days ago. I posted a link to a story by Darren Taylor in which he talked about South African soothsayers or Sangomas, traditional healers, predicting the winners of this Africa Cup of Nations. So I kind of put the question out, who do you think will be in Sunday's final in Libreville? And so this was a couple days ago, mm-hmm, before the Egypt victory in the semifinals. Rafael Modric says he predicts a Ghana versus Egypt final, and he says Egypt will lift the trophy.
Mm.
Magnus Chisholm Onwudiwe, a longtime listener of the Sunny Side of Sports, he says, I see Egypt in the final. As to who will lift the trophy, very difficult to say. Egypt is a seven-time champion of the Nations Cup.
Mm.
And Magnus gives us a little biblical reference here. He says, Ghana and Cameroon equally stand a chance to win, but Egypt in the final, it's going to be like the Israelites crossing the Red Sea.
Wow.
So there you go.
Yeah. I'm not quite sure what to do with that. We'll just let that comment sit there. It'll be a great. When is the final?
Interestingly, Doug, the final's on Sunday, the same day as Super Bowl 51.
Yes, indeed.
So
wow.
Two big football competitions, one soccer, of course, and the other American-style football.
We're going to have a lot to talk about on next Friday. Let me just mention something else that's trending. This has been for a couple days. I just haven't gotten around to it. Very quickly, Dale Earnhardt Jr. is a national championship race car driver, well-loved, comes from a family of, Dale Earnhardt is just sort of synonymous with racing. Well, the other day, he actually sent out a tweet. He saw a tweet that somebody had put out, a refugee, Gelar Budiarma, and he responded, Earnhardt Jr. responded. And he says, my family immigrated from Germany in the 1700s, escaping religious persecution. America is created by immigrants. Mm, and he later went on to say, Earnhardt, I just wanted to show him some compassion. I looked at his profile and I saw he was a NASCAR fan. I just felt like reaching out. Well, a lot of people are reaching back in turn to Dale Earnhardt Jr. and saying, thank you on social media, on Facebook, on Twitter, on Instagram, lots of pictures of him. Thank you at Dale Jr. Let's see. Number 88, that's what he races under. Number 88 forever. The significance of Dale Earnhardt Jr.'s immigration tweet cannot be overstated. Let's see. Here we go. Oh, well, there's several others. I hear the music, but there's a lot of talk on that on social media right now as well.
Thank you, Doug. VOA's Doug Bernard. And that wraps up the February 2nd edition of the Sunny Side of Sports. Thanks to Voice of America producer Bill Werkinger. Thanks also to VOA engineer Rob McLean. And thank you for tuning in. I'm VOA Sonny Young in Washington, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is a leader in supporting the clearance of dangerous remnants of war all over the world. Since 1993, we have invested more than $2.6 billion to clear or destroy landmines, unexploded ordnance, and other dangerous conventional weapons and munitions. In doing so, we are helping post-conflict communities to recover and to rebuild. One of our success stories is Zimbabwe's Burma Valley. Located on Zimbabwe's border with Mozambique, Burma Valley is a hot, low-lying area where generation after generation of farmers planted tobacco and fruit trees. But due to its strategic position, in the 1970s during Zimbabwe's War of Liberation, thousands upon thousands of landmines were sown throughout the area to prevent cross-border raids by guerrilla fighters. By the time the war ended in 1980, Zimbabwe was peppered with very dense, unfenced minefields. Even to this day, Zimbabwe is one of the most highly mine-impacted countries in the world. Leftover landmines and unexploded munitions stand in the way of post-conflict stabilization and inhibit long-term development. They render thousands of acres of land unusable and destabilize communities, and the remnants of war continue to claim new victims. Since 1980, more than 1,500 Zimbabwean people and 120,000 livestock have been killed in landmine accidents. Indeed, in some districts, the cattle are trained to move to pasture in a single file to minimize their exposure to anti-personnel landmines. One of the organizations working to clear landmines in Zimbabwe is Norwegian People's Aid. With support and funding provided by the United States, this group surveyed Burma Valley and cleared the landmines, completing operations in 2015. This effort to help Zimbabwe safely clear landmines and unexploded munitions has made a life-changing difference for area residents. The farmers have moved back, rebuilding homes and cattle corrals, and tilling and planting the recently demined fields. Over the last 4 years, the United States has provided more than $7.6 million for humanitarian demining in Zimbabwe, $3 million of it in 2016 alone. The United States is investing in mine and explosive clearance because by doing so, we not only protect civilians from explosive remnants of war, but we also enable lasting peace.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Hello, I'm Douglas Impoga. Join me for Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share their ideas on the topic at hand. So, please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
Are you suffering from heartache? No problem. We've got the cure for you. The African beat can soothe your heartache with its awesome tunes from the African continent. So join me, David Vandy, Mondays through Fridays at 0900 and 2000 Universal Time for a healing journey. I guarantee it.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, an in-depth look at the northern Nigeria-based terrorist group Boko Haram. The militant group has targeted both Muslims and Christians, killing more than 20,000 people since 2009. VOA has exclusively obtained secret video shot by Boko Haram that identifies its operatives committing acts of terror. We'll discuss the violent organization on the next Straight Talk Africa at 18:30 UTC.